So let's get going. Yesterday in the office hours, there were some number of questions about this linkage, flux linkage. Some people are confused about it. Therefore, I want to say once again a few things about that. Suppose that you have a coil, a closed loop. Okay? It could be a wire or it could be just a contour like that. It doesn't matter. Okay? And suppose that there are magnetic fields that are passing through it. Okay? Saying that magnetic fields are passing through it is somewhat vague. Okay? To make it less vague, we use the term link. Okay? And the idea is like this. If something is going through really, it is linked. Okay? Anything that is going through, whatever that means, is linked in the sense that magnetic field lines always close upon themselves. Okay? And therefore, if this is the ring and this is the magnetic field, they are like this. They are linked. They are like the two links of a chain. Chain is composed of many, many rings that are linked together to one another. Okay? So this is what we mean by linked. And of course, there are many, many field lines passing through this. They are all linked. Maybe these magnetic field lines are coming from some source here. And it is possible that source is also generating. And let's make it more specific. And they are doing this, of course. Okay? And then there may be certain field lines coming out from the same source, which are not passing through the first, and that field line is not linked. Okay, some are linked, some are not linked, but the ones that are linked are clear. And then I can get rid of this mysterious looking box and create another coil, because that coil can be then viewed to be the source of the magnetic field that goes and links through the other one. Any questions about this? Another way of, instead of linkage, we could say the following. Think of this as real wire. Okay, you take this wire loop and you stick it into a soapy water and you pull it out. What do you see? There is going to be a film of soap, foam, that is crossing that area. Okay, all the field lines that link that loop are going to be also the field lines that pierce that bubble. Okay. That bubble in its own will be a minimal bubble, okay? But you can take that bubble and go a little bit like this. You make it concave or convex, okay? And this is a toy that you have all played, and therefore you exactly know what I'm talking about. So whether that surface is flat, the minimum energy one, or the one that has been sort of stressed, it doesn't matter, okay? The same field lines that are linking the original wire will be piercing either of those surfaces. And then, when we talk about the flux of those field lines which are linking, i.e. those field lines which are piercing the surface, then we are talking about the surface integral. That's what a flux is. Surface integral over what? Over any surface that is connecting that closed loop. So I can actually calculate my flux using this surface or this surface. It doesn't matter. I'm going to get the same result. Why am I going to get the same result? For the magnetic field.
The same amount of field lines pass through every surface.
Yeah, but the surface has changed a little bit. Okay, the size of the surfaces is slightly different, so you may suspect perhaps it is different. There's something else, though. The field lines, you have to remember, on every surface, you have to take the dot multiplication of the surface element with the local field line, okay? The field lines are curving, the area is changing, the area normals are changing. So you may be a suspicious mind and say, maybe they are not the same, okay? But they are the same. Why are they same? It's related to what you are saying. It is because of the magnetic topology. There is another way of expressing this magnetic topology, and that is to say divergence of B is equal to
zero.
If divergence of B is equal to zero, my friend, how does that manifest itself in an integral form? So indeed, divergence of B is zero, but divergence of D is not equal to zero, right? But because divergence of B is equal to zero, we have the surface integral of B dot ds that is equal to zero. But divergence of D is not equal to zero. Because of that, the surface integral, closed surface integral of D dot ds, that is equal to charge. And then with charge, there is stuff coming out of that charge. The topology is different, okay? So basically, I claim that, so sort of like non-disagreement, but maybe a little bit more quantitatively. Flux that you calculate over here or here have to be the same, because if they were not same, then there would be, I would create a violation of this guy. Okay, if they were not equal, I would then have to be conceding that the full integral, because the upper plus lower surface creates a constant, a closed surface, with an enclosed volume. Then if they were not the same, I would have to conclude inside that closed volume there is some magnetic charge, but that we don't see that, and because of that it is equal to zero. Okay, so from now on, when we have a closed contour and an area that is included, that area is a very general area. It's any one of those areas. Okay? Or maybe you should sort of think of that closed contour as always the edge of an area. Which area is actually a family of areas that is associated with each contour. Any questions? All right, so then that takes us back to this result and the magnetic field structure of a closed loop. And I said this is a dipole. The field structure that we see here is very reminiscent of the field structure of an electric dipole. What is an electric dipole? Plus and minus charges separated by some distance. Okay? Actually, the field structure are identical in the far field, but near the two, in the vicinity of the actual magnetic dipole and the electric dipole, the topologies are different. Okay? Remember, in the electric dipole, the field lines are actually ending, starting on plus charges, going to minus charges, so the details in this vicinity is different. Whereas here, you're always creating loops. Far field, away from, at large distances, to the size of the either the radius A of the loop or the D size of the dipole, if you are at R much, much larger than A or D, you have identical structure. Now, the simplest static charge distribution is a point charge. I would say the next simplest one is a dipole. Okay? There is no, the simplest magnetic field source is this guy. Okay? So, to the extent that it makes sense to say that the second simplest static charge distribution is a dipole instead of a monopole. Monopole is the absolute simplest, dipole is the second one, but there is no magnetic monopole. Magnetic dipole is then the simplest distribution. So you can say that all magnetic fields are in some sense superpositions of fields like this put together. Any questions here? Now, what about magnets? Well, magnets are composed of elements that can be reduced to the simplest magnetic sources that we can think about. They are the loops, okay? So what you see as a permanent magnet is some material in which at the atomic level, evidently there are current loops that are generating the magnetic fields that are produced by this thing, okay? Now if these current loops are randomly oriented, they will cancel one another and there will be no net magnetic effect. But if they are aligned, then there is going to be quite a bit of magnetic field that is generated in the vicinity, and that's what permanent magnets are. So some materials have their internal currents aligned in some way, or they can be forced into that. In that case, you have a permanent magnet. Okay, so basically, any permanent magnet can be sort of like thought of as having some loop inside. Okay, so now I look at those two loops and say, I had two magnets side by side. This is representing one of the magnets, this is representing the other magnet. Are these magnets going to attract or repel? They're going to attract because basically these two currents are in the same direction. That's what we learned a couple of days ago. Currents that are running parallel to one another in the same direction, they will attract one another. If they are opposite, they will repel. And you know this very well from since your childhood playing with magnets, refrigerator magnets. If you approach them one way, they will suck and become one, they will join, and if you approach them the other way, they push. They want to rotate and get together the other way around. Anyway, so there we go. These loops and their magnetic fields are very important, and they underlie the much of magnetism that we are aware of from our day-to-day experience with magnets lying around. In addition, this structure with the field lines obeying this equation that I have written. The distance to any one of those field lines is the distance of the same field line at the equator times sine squared theta, where theta is measured from the top. okay? Pole attitude, so to speak, is relevant also to the Earth, okay? In what sense? We have a current loop, just like the one that is depicted here, that is running in the molten core of Earth and generates the magnetic fields that all our compasses are responding to, right? So, because right at the beginning of the semester, I said, are there magnetic field lines inside this room? And the answer was yes, and what was it? Well, we said there's all sorts of radio waves passing through, they certainly have magnetic fields, but even more prominent answer would have been, yes, there is a magnetic field, because if I have a compass, that compass is going to align itself and point to the north. That particular north, sort of like oriented, north-pointing magnetic field that is passing through this room is generated by a current loop at the molten Earth, core of the Earth. Okay, so somewhere there inside we have hot stuff, iron, nickel, etc., all melted. This is a conducting fluid, and in this conducting fluid, for some mysterious reason, there is a current that is flowing, a current ring, and that current ring is producing a magnetic field that is surrounding us and protecting us, okay? So there is a current ring. Now, maybe you know, maybe you don't know, the Earth's magnetic field points towards the North Pole, okay? From the South Pole to the North Pole. So if we use our right-hand rule and I say the current is going in this direction, I get the wrong result. The current has to be going in this direction. So it is going from east to west, and that produces for me magnetic field lines that are like this. Okay. So we have two poles, North Pole and North Geographic Pole, South Geographic Pole, and magnetically it's the other way around. That is by convention, that's what we say. Okay. Any questions about this? So this is a very good thing. Okay, so then we have here our little compass. There is a local magnetic field pointing to the north, and our composite instrument that is going to point out to that location. Now it's not going to go exactly into the geographic pole, because this current that I'm talking about is not exactly running, turning around according to it's sort of like tilted with respect to the geographic pole. By geographic pole, of course, I mean the rotation axis of the Earth. So there is a slight tilt, and because of that, there is a difference between the geographic north and the north that the compass points. It's a small difference, so you can get away without knowing that. If you want precise information, then you nowadays depend on something else, and that's called GPS. We are basing many of our orientation-related applications with GPS these days. And there's more and more that you can learn about GPS if you take 350, and we actually have a course on GPS at 456, I believe. 456 might be the course on GPS with a very nice lab component. So sort of like plan for that if you are interested in this sort of thing. Any questions here? Now, this Earth's magnetic field not only helps us to navigate, but it also protects us. We are there because of this magnetic field, okay? This magnetic field keeps our atmosphere intact. Mars, once upon a time, had a magnetic field and had an atmosphere. It lost its magnetic field, and then it lost its atmosphere. The reason is, there is this streaming plasma coming out from the sun. We are embedded in a river of charged particles passing us by, because the sun is effectively boiling and sending us supersonic plasma that is passing us. Equal numbers of more or less electrons and ions, protons and electrons, is just streaming through the interplanetary space, and that would hit us, except that our magnetic field, this guy, is protecting us. Okay? Now, this magnetic field is our protector, but it is also changing in time. Okay, so this pole, the magnetic pole, is actually slowly varying around the geographic north. Okay, so that's it's something dynamic. Why is it dynamic? Because the current that is producing it inside is dynamic. Moreover, you might say, who created that current? Well, that is a mystery. Well, there are some ideas, but the problem has not quite been solved. But we're going to learn about Faraday's law today, okay? We're going to find out today, or stress the fact that if you have time-varying currents, that's going to generate new time-varying currents in any other conducting body, okay? And At some point, in an earlier stage, a current might have been generated at the core, at the molten core of the Earth, because of a time-varying current in the solar wind, something like that, that captures. Once you have a current, that current produces the magnetic field. But now, this magnetic field is residing partially inside the molten core, which is a conductor, but it is a fluid conductor. It also is rotating with respect to Earth. And if you have a fluid conductor that is moving in the reference frame where you see the magnetic field, there is going to be B cross B forces. Okay, and those forces will now redirect the position. It will sort of change the configuration of the current a little bit. A changed current will create, mean change magnetic field. So it's a very complicated so-called dynamo problem. That problem hasn't been fully solved. The elements are understood, but numerical models trying to sort of model this correctly are still in the process of being generated. Moreover, there are mysteries. This magnetic field, what we call the south magnetic pole or north pole, where the magnetic field lines are coming downwards. That region used to have magnetic field lines going upwards instead of downwards some 600,000 years ago or so. Okay, so geologists have find the fingerprints of the direction in which the magnetic field lines point at different epochs. You can cut the molten core sort of like comes out and deposits frozen material, frozen magma at certain places inside the ocean, where the plate tectonics, the different plates that represent different continents get together, there are cracks. From these cracks come out the molten magma, which then sort of freezes when it hits the water. And that, when it freezes with a memory of the current direction of the magnetic field. And when you cut through this and analyze the sort of the orientation of the little magnetized particles which have been frozen there aligned with the magnetic field at the time when the magma came and froze, you see that there are reversals. The reversals come around with a sort of more or less every several hundred thousand years, let's say 400,000 years or so, there is a reversal. We've been in our epoch now 600,000 years in the same epoch, so we are way overdue for a reversal. And again, why does it reverse? We don't quite understand. But reversal certainly means that a current that is going this way, after the reversal, is pointing in the other direction. You might say, maybe the current is stopping and then going the other direction. But there's evidence that's not really what is happening. It sort of works out that this current loop breaks into multiple current loops. And instead of a single dipole, you generate a field structure that surrounds this as monopoles, multipoles. You have many, many poles. Each pole is blessed with aurora borealis. Do you guys know about aurora borealis? What happens is that these solar wind particles that are passing us by, they have an opportunity to get into the Earth system at the North Pole and the South Pole. They can't get into the Earth system right near the equator. Why is that? A charged particle banging into a magnetic field, what is it going to feel? Lorentz force, yeah. And what is that Lorentz force going to do? So let's look at this briefly here. This is the direction of B. Here's the direction B of, let's say, a proton. Then B cross B takes and it points out. So all the protons come in this direction and all the electrons are going in the other direction, right? So somehow the charged particles, instead of going into our system, they are going around. This is the protection that I was talking about. And that's very interesting because if all the protons are coming in this direction and the electrons are going in that direction, there has been a, what has been generated? A current, in fact, almost a surface current, if you wish. It's not, of course, surface because this is somewhat distributed, but there is a current, so there is a J that is sticking out. If there is a J sticking towards you, what does that J generate? J's always generate? Say it.
B field.
A B field, a new B field is generated. So because there is this Earth's magnetic field that is coming from the current that is inside, that plus B cross B generates a new current, okay? This is called, by the way, magnetopause. A magnetopause current is generated, and that current itself generates a magnetic field. Let us follow that magnetic field. With J going in this direction, I have a B that's going in this direction, and I have a B that is going in the other direction. Am I doing this right? J, and that is going to be, so let me do this right. V cross B, J. J, and then I have a magnetic field that's pointing in this direction, and that's pointing in this direction. Jason, did I do it right? Or Mike? Okay, so now, what's the effect of that? On the inside side, I created a magnetic field that was in the same direction as the Earth's magnetic field, and on the outside part, what did I generate? Opposite. So on the outside part, the magnetic field, due to this magnetopause current, sort of canceled out Earth's magnetic field, but it strengthens Earth's magnetic field in the inside. The overall effect is that the solar wind, as it bangs into our magnetosphere and generates this current so that charged particles can go around without penetrating and destroying our atmosphere, they are also compressing our magnetic field. They take our magnetic field and push it closer to the Earth. Okay? The stronger this flow, the more stress there is, the more push there is. Now, that velocity of the solar wind is time-dependent. You guys have heard about solar storms? We are moving into a solar maximum. There is an 11-year cycle of the activity of solar flares, okay? Every 11 years it peaks up. We're just moving into one of predicted very strong solar maximum. This year, next year, and so forth. There's going to be lots of solar effects. And every time there is a flare, then there is a push. When that push happens, the front end gets compressed, and the back end, it turns out that it pulls like a slingshot, okay? So a lot of corresponding electrodynamics. A lot of charged particle generation, aurora borealis increases, more particles come in. And in any case, this activity, changing magnetic fields mean, according to today's lecture that I haven't started, dBdt means inductive current. So if you have changing magnetic field because the solar wind is pushing, there is going to be all sorts of electric fields that are generating within our ionosphere and even the surface. Power lines carry some of this current, and that sometimes causes the switches to be, or the fuses to blow, etc. Okay, so you can get outages and so forth due to this solar effects, which is something that we call nowadays space weather. So we are going into a sort of a dangerous time over the next year or two. So you'll be reading about these things perhaps in newspapers, or it may even affect you. There has been some very extreme solar storms that has caused havoc with some of our systems. Anyway, so these are some interesting things that you may think about. So our right-hand rule, the fact that currents generate magnetic fields, and you superpose those ideas, these are basic, simple ideas, but as you can see, you can already predict a lot of things that are of importance. Any questions here? So I'm going to send a link to a NOAA program where there is a very nice one-hour discussion of Earth's magnetic field, the existing theories of how it may be really generated, why is this current generated, and so forth, and how over the next 1,000 years or so, humankind is going to experience these multiples and all that. There's going to be aurora borealis at the equator and all that. And hopefully we'll be advanced enough that during that time, where less protection because of magnetic field, we will still be able to survive. Our technologies are going to keep us flywheeling through that particular epoch. So our species, how old are we species-wise? 5 million, is that what they are? Okay, so as primates, maybe 5 million, but as speaking guys like you and I, 40,000 years. Last 40,000 years ago, they painted these walls in somewhere in France. They made first pictures. This is the same time frame where evidence shows that people really started speaking. Okay, language was developed. So we became what we are more or less 40,000 years ago. We've been sitting under the same magnetic field lines, more or less, no flip and off. So it will be the first generation over the next 2,000 years or so who will be experiencing this. Okay, so good enough. So now you know why I made this picture. And by the way, we have people in our department who study these sorts of things. I am one of them. Steve Frank is the other one. John Nicola is the other one. We do space weather, and we use remote sensing tools to study the ionosphere, magnetosphere, and some of these interactions. And also Farzad Kamalabadi, who does the signal processing associated with this sort of thing. Next lecture, Faraday's laws induce EMF. Okay, stuff that I have been alluding to. So, early 1800s, people already know that currents produce magnetic fields. Oersted, Gauss, etc. had figured this out. Currents generate magnetic fields, and you can notice that if you have a compass. You have a compass sitting in the lab, and you create some current somewhere, that compass needle shakes. All right, so now Faraday is trying to work out whether the reverse is true. Can I have magnets generating currents on pieces of wires? But what is a magnet? By this time, we know that magnet is a current loop. So you can pose the question, are current loops carrying currents able to produce currents in nearby wire loops? And wires or wire loops? You really have to consider wire loops because, you know, if you have a wire that is not connected, it is open, it's not going to carry much of a current. So you do the experiment with coils, okay? One coil has current, some other coil is sitting by, and he measures no current there, okay? So magnetic field is not generating current. But then, when he changes the current in the original current loop, he notices that there is a momentary current that flows in the second loop when the current in the first loop is changing as a function of time. And then he says, okay, it must be as follows. The current that is changing in my first loop is creating a change in the magnetic field that it produces. Okay, already they know that currents produce magnetic fields, but if I change my current, the magnetic field is going to change. And evidently then he says, changing magnetic fields effectively generates some sort of an electric field, and this is electric field is responsible for the current that flows in the second loop. As soon as the current change in the original loop stops, then there is no more electric field, and the other current is going to stop because probably the other wire is resistive and it's not going to carry the same current forever. He didn't have superconductors then, so that was just the original result. So we call this induction, Faraday's induction. Okay. So roughly speaking, then this is the way you should look at things. Changing currents produce changing magnetic fields, and changing magnetic fields go hand in hand with electric fields that are generated. These are no longer the static electric fields. For static electric fields, curl of E is equal to zero. But we know those electric fields are produced by static distribution of charges. Okay, so basically curl of E equals zero as long as you have static charges. But if you have currents that are flowing because now time-varying electric fields have been generated because there are time-varying currents around, then this is not equal to zero. So Faraday collects a lot of data, but he doesn't know enough math, so then he doesn't write the following equation. This following equation is written down by Maxwell, okay, based on Faraday's evidence. So you now think that as long as the charges that are around are all stationary, all the fields that they can generate are going to be curl-free. But as soon as currents are being produced because these charges are moving, but they are moving also in such a way that current is not steady, something else comes in, okay? Now, the electric fields are not only produced by the presence of the charges, by their existence, but also because of their dynamics. So electric field no longer manages to be curl-free. It has another component on top of it. Superposition applies. Okay, so certainly certain portion of the electric field can be curl-free, but the total electric field is not curl-free anymore. You have to add something to the other side. And Maxwell says, hey, that is minus dB dt. This minus sign is important. Eventually, it is related to something that we call Lenz's law that you may have heard. And that is Maxwell's version of Faraday's equation. But Faraday didn't write it this way. How did Faraday write it? Faraday wrote it in a way that resembled this. Okay. In fact, Faraday didn't even write this. He wrote it in a more simple way. We can write that equation from this equation by simply invoking Stokes' theorem. What do? Let's look at this equation. What do I have here? On this side, I have the surface integral of the magnetic field, dB dt, the right-hand side of this equation. And on the other side, I have a closed-loop integral. So the kind of integral that is being represented here, for which Stokes' theorem is relevant, is a line integral around the contour and surface integral over the area that is associated with that contour. Okay? So that is what we know. Alright, so then let's just do that. Let's apply that to both sides of this equation. And then we have the closed loop integral of curl of E. Sorry, closed surface integral. And I don't have to say closed. The surface integral of curl of E, which is a vector, dotted into ds. Now I'm going to apply the same thing on the other side. And that I can pull out the minus sign. And that's going to be dv dt dot ds. And again, the surface integral. So you can write that. And then, because you know some math and Stokes' theorem, then you say, but the surface integral is related to the contour integral. That is simply the closed contour integral that is over C of E dot dl. Okay, so Stokes' theorem being used at that stage. And you have already worked out your Stokes' theorem in your math courses. You know all about it. You know all about the relationship, in which direction you have to go around the contour with respect to the original ds you had, and that is the right-hand rule related one. You say, hey, I have this equation. So this is the differential form of Faraday's law. Here is the integral form. But integral form is not yet the way Faraday wrote it. Okay, but let's discover how Faraday wrote it. Any questions so far? So basically now, I have a statement here. I take an arbitrary contour, and it can be a wire loop, but it can be also an arbitrary contour in space in our mind, a mathematical, no physical object, just a path. Okay, over that path, I'm going to consider this integral, E dot dl integral. Okay, so my dls are pointing in the directions that I choose for my integration sense. And that is going to be associated with that surface. Using my right-hand rule, this is my dss, and I'm going to end up with this relationship. E dot dl is always going to be associated with dv dt, integrated over the surface. Now, if magnetic field is not changing as a function of time, this is equal to zero, and then I have circulation equals zero, conservative field situation. You go and calculate the potential by integrating from point A to B, and it doesn't matter whether you go like this or this. That is the situation. That requires the right-hand side to be zero. We are now violating that. That is being violated as long as there is dv dt. As soon as that is the case, we lose our good friend, voltage drop, in some sense. Okay. We will no longer be able to associate a potential, scalar potential, with each location that can be used for unambiguous calculation of the electric field by simply taking gradient. That's no longer a possibility. This is the new equation that we are dealing with. Okay, so let's move on. So here is my integration contour, and here is the surface that I'm considering it. Okay? Now, let us entertain the possibility that this contour is actually a wire loop. Okay? If that wire loop is sitting in some lab frame and not moving, then this statement is still true in that lab frame. As a mathematical entity, okay? And if the E dot dl is not equal to zero, in other words, dv dt is not equal to zero, and because of that, the right-hand side is not equal to zero, then I have a circulation. Instead of a zero circulation, a finite circulation. This quantity is something I call EMF, electromotive force, okay? We will find out that if you divide that EMF by the resistivity of that loop, you will get a current that is being produced, okay? So that's what Faraday was noticing in the lab, okay? Changing magnetic fields generate EMFs, and EMFs will drive currents if the loop is resistive, or conductive, I should say. If it is open, there is going to be no current, but if it's not open, so there is a finite resistance, you just divide the EMF by the resistance and you get a current. Now, in which direction does the current go? This is where Lenz's law comes into play, okay? If a current is going to now be flowing in this wire, okay, it will generate its own magnetic field. True? Because every current generates its own magnetic field. Now, the current is going to flow in that direction, not the other one, such that the magnetic field that it produces is going to be against the change that is causing the entire induction. Okay? The magnetic flux through this thing is either increasing or decreasing. Okay? If it is increasing, That is going to generate a current that is flowing in such direction that the magnetic field that produces will try to keep the magnetic total magnetic field from increasing. In other words, it's going to be pointing in the other direction. So that is Lenz's law. And that is in consistency with this minus sign, and we'll see more of that soon enough. Okay, so far so good. But now in the lab, I consider this wire loop, not stationary sitting on the table, but moving with respect to the lab. Okay? So I make a distinction between these two conditions now. In the first condition, where it is stationary, it doesn't matter whether I'm taking the flux of the time rate of change of B or the other way around. I pull ddt outside, first calculate the flux, and then calculate the time rate of change of flux. It doesn't matter which way I do it if the wire is sitting stationary in my lab. Okay? So, therefore, we now reach the next version of the equation. We pull ddt out, okay, and then we get a flux. Flux is B dot ds. Okay, that flux B dot ds is calculated over a surface. Which surface? Either the simplest surface or the bump surface. Does it matter? It doesn't matter. Okay, that is the flux. Now, the flux, does the flux depend on x, y, z coordinates? Once the wire is stationary, it no longer does, because the surface area integral, once you do it, its x, y, z dependence over that surface area goes, it's just a number. Okay, it's just a number that doesn't depend on x, y, and z. It just depends on the shape of that wire. But it depends on t, right? It potentially depends on t if the magnetic field linking the wire is changing as a function of time. Why? Because its source is changing, something like that. Okay, so it may have a time derivative that is non-zero. But I don't need to put a partial time derivative anymore. I put a total time derivative because the quantity that I'm dealing with is only a function of time. All right? So that's another form of Faraday's law. Now, can I use this law as is if my wire is moving? The answer is no, because then I cannot pull ddt. Okay? Because the integration contour is changing, I can no longer assume that I am dealing with the same area in doing the area integral. As I'm changing my wire's location, the surface area over which I have to calculate the surface integral of dv dt is changing. Therefore, it's a little bit more complicated. But lucky enough, I can still write Faraday's law in a way in which the right-hand side is the time derivative of the flux rather than the flux of the time derivative of the magnetic field, as long as I make adjustment on the other side of my equation. Okay? So suppose that my wire is moving now in the lab frame with a velocity v. It turns out that if I put to the line integral e dot dl integral the following modification, e plus v cross b dl, then that changes, completely compensates for the change between the partial time derivative flux versus the time derivative of the flux. Okay, so I am able to write at the end of the day the entire equation in this form. I am now going to put the right hand side as the time derivative of the flux, whether or not my wire is moving or not, as long as I compensate for the wire's motion on the right hand side with B cross B. Any questions? Now all this detail is derived on the right hand side on this margin. If you are interested why that works out this way, in the margin I show that if I consider the total time derivative of BDS, that can be written to be the integral of the time derivative, partial time derivative of the magnetic field minus this correction factor. That minus correction factor comes to the other side. I am able to write down the Faraday's law in the way more or less Faraday wrote. Okay, so that result is derived in the margin. Okay, and I am not going to go through the situation, but the situation illustrated in this picture. I have my first contour, C. That contour, after a time difference, delta t, becomes a new contour. Okay? Now I have to consider the surface integral, the flux, over two areas. One area is the area that is connecting the first contour, The second one is the second area that is connecting the second contour. These are two different contours, two different areas to calculate flux from. And then you're going to end up with different fluxes. Okay, but you can take the two flux expressions and divide it by delta t. That would give you a development towards deep c dt, the time derivative of the flux. That is the derivation. If you wish, you can follow in the sidelines. Okay, and that equation, it's not very hard. Easy this, and this is exactly what I'm using over there to obtain Faraday's law. Yeah, let us look at Faraday's law in the way Faraday wrote it. Basically, he's going to give this guy a name. Here I have the total force per unit charge. I consider the total force per unit charge being integrated around a closed loop. Okay? I'm going to call this EMF, electromotive force. It is not really a force. It's force per unit charge, but nevertheless, that's the name. Okay? EMF, and there is a name for it, a letter, a Greek letter, sort of like an epsilon. It's the same as the permittivity thing, but it's written like this. Electromotive force. Electromotive force, in calculating electromotive force, I should include all the forces, not just the electrical force, but all the forces. That B cross B is the additional force that I have to consider. And that is going to be equal, evidently, negative of the total time derivative of a quantity that is referred to as the flux. Epsilon equals minus ddt of magnetic flux. This is how Faraday wrote his equation. So a lot of calculus is now gone, right? It is almost algebraic. There is a derivative, but none of this complicated three-dimensional integrations, etc., showing up. He has the notion of a flux. He's considering its time derivative. And he says, if the flux over a closed loop is changing as a function of time, that is going to generate an EMF. That EMF drives the current. This is the gist of it. This is the way Faraday wrote his equations. Any questions here? So, a lot of equations that we saw, they are all different facets of Faraday's law. Today, we say Faraday's law is this thing. In most of our work, this is what serves us. But this form of the equation is very useful for guys doing power work, okay? They don't need all the details. They don't need all the details of the full set of Maxwell's equations. If they can just figure out what the flux is across, what is the flux linking a certain loop, coil? Is it changing? If it is changing, I have an EMF. If there is an EMF, it's good. What do? I generate some magnetic field source. I have some magnet. Near this magnet, I have a loop. I take this loop and I start rotating it. When I rotate the loop, because of the geometry, magnetic geometry in a certain direction, there is going to be a flux change as a function of time. And that is going to drive a current. Now I'm going to take that current and couple it to the network. Which network? The power network that takes all these things. So you have, where is the loop? Near some waterfall, Niagara Falls, okay? Where there's lots of kinetic energy to take and turn coils around and around in the presence of a magnetic field. The kinetic energy is turning into electrical energy that is powering what we are doing. So Faraday came with all this stuff less than 200 years ago. I think it was 1830. Now we are 2010, 2012. Less than 200 years ago, we didn't know how to do this stuff. Okay? 200 years ago, we didn't know how to do this stuff. Then Faraday comes, discovers this. We have all over this country all these power plants. Not this country, the whole world. Our world was transformed pretty much by this equation. Pretty much even this equation rather than that one. So it's phenomenal. Of course, fueled its industrial revolution, got into the next phase, and that brought us into all the way to the information age that we are having right now. Any questions here? So I have example problem where I rotate a coil and calculate the corresponding current, for instance. And if you are more interested in this sort of thing, what do you take? ECE 330. This is where this topic is covered. Other things. You generate a current, and then it induces a current on the other side. And this is how transformers work. And where do you learn about transformers once again in more detail than here mentioned? again 330. So 330 is a course that really needs to be taken to complete your sort of first pass education in electrical engineering. Things that we left out in 210, sorry. And that was because we had to do some math and then focus on communication aspects and signal processing aspects. There is some more physical stuff that is sitting there in 330 waiting. How many of you have already taken 330? Just a few. How many are planning to take this course? I think everybody should be raising their hands. It's an important course. Okay. As I said, all those 305s are very important to complete. Any questions? So, examples, or even here is Faraday's law, the way Faraday wrote it. Okay, so this Lenz's law is important. Okay, the current goes in that direction to produce a magnetic field that opposes the change in magnetic field that fueled the whole process. Suppose that it actually went in the same direction. The magnetic field is increasing and the current generates even more increased magnetic field. Then what would happen? That would then generate a very unstable situation. Now, the magnetic field is changing even more so, okay? And because of that, even more current is flowing. If more current is flowing, there is even more so production of the magnetic field. This is a very unstable situation. The whole universe would explode in that sense. So Lenz's law and the position of that minus sign there is crucial. This is the stable solution, the only solution that makes sense, and that's how it comes about. And did we derive it? No, we observed it, okay? But had it been the other way around, we wouldn't have been able to observe it because we wouldn't have it here. That's a sort of a weird thing to say, but it had to be this way. Okay, so once again, these equations were not derived, they were compiled, and Faraday was compelled to put a minus sign, otherwise he was having the wrong things over there. That percolates itself. Now you can go back from that equation to this equation, having the minus sign over here. Summarize, all right, so there are some pictures now. All right, so basically, I have in here some sort of a loop, and it is moving with some velocity, and through it is a linked flux of magnetic field, okay? Because it is moving, perhaps it is going from a region where the magnetic field was intense to a region in which magnetic field is weak. That already means that because of its motion, there is, in this case, not because of time variation, but in its frame of reference, it looks like time variation, magnetic field is falling, therefore there is a deep CDT, that is non-zero, and that is going to generate a EMF, and that EMF is going to generate a corresponding current. Okay, so this here is our total EMF, and this shows that the EMF can be coming about, just because of the motion in a setting where there is a magnetic field. According to Faraday's laws, it appears that a non-zero EMF can always be caused by magnetic flux variations independent of how the variations are produced. There are many possibilities. One, a fixed contour but time-varying B. Okay? So you have a contour but the B is varying. Why is the B varying? Maybe you have a magnet that you're rotating around. Or maybe the magnet is stationary but you're working turning this around, and that's one of the other case. B is constant in space and time, but time varying C, that is the case. Rotating or changing size. You're distorting or rotating or moving. An inhomogeneous static B in the measurement frame and C in motion. Okay, so these are all possible. It doesn't matter how the C changes. If C changes, if d dt of C is not equal to zero, then there is an EMF and there is a current that is produced. Does it sound like magic? It does sound like magic to me, but that's the way it is. However, where is this all coming from? Is there something new? Okay, in what sense? Well, we started with Coulomb's law. Coulomb's law gave us the electrostatic field. Then we went into DC magnetic field two lectures ago. How did we derive the DC magnetic field? Jason, what did we do? We said something about Lorentz contraction and all that, right? Taking that into account, we saw that the DC magnetic field came from still Coulomb's law. There are no magnetic charges. It's just the presence of the charged particles seen in a reference frame that is other than ours is causing us DC magnetic field. Now, that DC magnetic field is due to current. If you change the current, that DC magnetic field is no longer going to stay DC. Okay? It becomes an AC magnetic field. What we are really experiencing here is that this time-changing current not only generates a time-changing magnetic field, but it adds a time-changing component into electric field as well. That is what we are seeing. So it is incorrect to interpret this particular equation saying time variation of B is causing a time-varying electric field that has a curl. That's really not the case. The case is the causes are still J's and rho's. When J's and rho's are not changing in time, you get stationary B's and stationary E's. When J's and rho's are changing in time, then you get time-varying E and B. It's just the case that this guy and this guy, caused by a time-varying current, matches one another. It's not that dB dt causes, although it appears that way in this equation, that is not the case. So I think it is more magical if you say time-varying magnetic field is there, therefore there is a time-varying electric field that this time-varying magnetic field produced. That sounds magical, but that is not the case. The case is more sort of basic in the sense that it is always the rho's and j's which are responsible for both of these effects, and time variation of rho's and j's are giving us. So you should interpret that Maxwell's equation, maybe from a philosophical standpoint, just like that. But it nevertheless is the case that if you do rotate stuff in the presence of magnetic fields, you generate EMFs. Okay. Anything else that I want to talk about in this lecture? Please read this lecture very carefully and ask me if you have any particular questions. Here's one example. I guess I ran out of time. I will go through these examples Monday. There are four very important examples here. Now, homework will be collected on today at 5, and I'm going to now put a new set of homework at Tuesday that is going to have a whole bunch of Faraday's law related questions. Okay? And if you read this lecture, you can start doing them over the weekend. You will learn the rest in class. Yes. Okay.